You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 86, Kioma and four other Italian exploitation classics from Franco Nero and Enzo G. Castellari. Featuring dirty cops, multiple mustaches, gunfights, car chases, crucifixions, shark hunters, mafiosos, Confederate killers, avenging half-breeds, and the signature Franco Nero bitch slap. Martin.
Yes.
He can't die. And you know why? Because he's free. And a man who's free never dies.
Don't give a damn. I am the Cobra. No one can tell me what to do. So when you're pleading and begging mercy, mercy on you, a heart of stone's the most you'll get now. Before I strike, you'll never know. Oh, 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 it's a dirty, dirty way. But that's the world. Be fast, be first to make your play. Coming soon the day, it's coming soon the day of the Cobra.
Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, so this actually seems like a me episode, but it's actually a you episode because you have decided, after years of me bugging you to do it, to go on your personal journey through Italian exploitation cinema. And you started with Franco Nero, and then we kind of spun that out and started watching all the Franco Nero and Enzo Castellari movies that they made together. But I'm going to put you on the hot seat for a second. Why now? Like, what was it that possessed you to where you're like, now is my time to watch all these fucking Italian trash genre movies?
This is going to sound probably a little heavy, but everything's so bad right now.
Sure.
That I don't want to watch the same things. I feel like during COVID in particular, I watched a lot of the same things over and over again in a very comfort food, comfort watch kind of mentality.
Sure.
I think a lot of us did.
I slipped into a few of those. Like, I watched Devil's Advocate the other night, which is a strange comfort
right,
movie.
Right, I just watched that too.
But I watch it like once every other year, I want to say, just because I like how fucking crazy, hammy, and cheesy it is. And it totally took me away to just being like, oh, that's right, movies are awesome.
Well, and I think in that mentality of movies are awesome, I remember when I was young, not to go too far back, but like when I was young, my dad, he noticed, he's like, Martin, you are so obsessed with movies, like more than most people, right?
Right.
And he's like, because you'll find a movie you like and you want to see everything with that person in it or everything about that director, which is very much how people like us and yeah. our listeners operate. Like, you find something you like, you're like, I need to see everything.
We're rabbit hole people. Right. I was just listening to the Zodiac episode that they just published for the Rewatchables. It's like their first one that went up on Netflix. And Sean Fantasy talked about something similar to where he was like, that's the reason why Zodiac appeals to like people like us. People who are like really into movies and things, is that we're rabbit hole people. We grab a hold of something we become fascinated by, and we just can't stop until we know every last little detail about that specific thing that appeals to us.
Well, yeah, and it's like sometimes I'll talk to people who aren't film people but who are true crime people. It's very similar to that, right? Which is
right.
Zodiac, right? Where it's like you get obsessed. And I feel like during COVID in particular, again, I was more stagnant with that, and I still have been, that I now, with access to all these movies through a lot of friends we have, I'm like, wait, I could watch anything I want to watch. And you, for years, have been saying, you know, Franco Nero, Castellari, Corbucci, all of these filmmakers from Italy. I don't know what it was. I had a mental block on it. And then I got Shark Hunter for Christmas. And because that was my way in with sharks, which we both, who I love. I watched, I was like, yep, I'm in. And then just went down.
Which is a weird entry point for all the Franco Nero movies. That's a real oddity. that was kind of lost for a long time.
Yeah,
until
like last year. Yeah.
From that Severin Discs release. But like, it's funny because most people come to him, well, through honestly Django Unchained,
right?
In you know modern times, because of Django. He's the original, you know, anti-hero from Sergio Corbucci's, you know, famous Western.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's absolutely. And I think I had for a long time had a weird negative view of a lot of spaghetti Westerns. Like, one of my favorite films, hands down, like top 10 favorite film is Once Upon a Time in the West, which obviously falls into that.
But knowing that about you, that's why I was always curious about your resistance to just Italian exploitation, especially like spaghetti Western stuff, because you love those movies. You love like the cornerstones of that kind of subgenre.
Yeah, and it's in I don't know. It's hard to explain, right? You have those blocks in your mind, or you have the like giant holes in your film knowledge. And I felt like this year was one of those years where I'm trying to make a movie myself, and I'm trying to just eat more different types of food, so to speak.
Sure.
And so also on my list is Japanese like Yakuza stuff this year, which is a huge oversight for me. And I know you're a big fan of as well. And obviously it's a cool way to connect closer to you and our friend Shapiro as well, of like, this is stuff both you guys love. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to talk to you about it. And also I genuinely enjoyed these movies, and through this also really branched out to, I mean, Corbucci was a lot of fun. And we'll do an episode on that as well at some point, so I don't want to go too far down that hole. But like,
yeah, this is the first of a few I think we're going to space out throughout the year as we kind of tackle
right
some little pockets inside of like Italian exploitation.
But it's just, I mean, I think I watched Shark Hunter, and then once I think it's when I did Kiyoma where I was like, I'm so in. Like,
yeah,
that's one of the reasons that's the film of this week, is that that movie's so fucking me. It's like mythic as hell, and something about Italian that I think it took me. I mean, this is like, well, duh, about Italian genre stuff is. And I was talking to Shapiro about this, about how there is an unreality to it, that it is.
Oh yeah,
because you have the post dubbing, post sync sound. You have this very arch kind of extra style of acting, usually. You have very mythic kind of storytelling, and also something we'll get into this episode is a lot of it's kind of ripoff cinema.
Well, and that's, you know, what I was going to say, is that there's always one very successful thing that the Italians then copy, rip off, and in the process, and we'll talk about a few instances of this, in the process, they spin out their own genres. You know, they basically invent them in real time because, I mean, the whole reason for spaghetti Westerns is Sergio Leone.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, Clint Eastwood. And that's what a lot of those movies are chasing, that success. And then they transmute into stuff like The Great Silence, you know, from Corbucci, which you also watched. Or Django, mm-hmm, you know, with Franco Nero, also Corbucci, who is, you know, not surprisingly, like one of Tarantino's favorite, you know, directors. But then you can do the same thing, is that like, we're going to talk about High Crime, one of Franco Nero's, Poliziotteschi. I don't believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, but I'm just going to roll with that.
Right.
But you know, without the French connection, you don't have basically all of Poliziotteschi,
right,
all these Italian crime movies. Because like High Crime, you know, Castellari even talks about, you know, he saw Bullet and was like, oh, shit, I want to do a car chase movie. And then French Connection comes out and is a huge hit. And you basically combine the two and it becomes what High Crime is, which is just this like nonstop, energetic, super violent cop movie about chasing down drug dealers and international drug dealers in very much the same way that, you know, Popeye Doyle does.
That's why I think I love your point about how it became this genre unto itself, while they were a lot of times birthed as a quote unquote ripoff, right? And what's fascinating is for a film like High Crime is that it has more insane action than French Connection. Like,
oh yeah, like, these are like entertainments.
That's what's crazy. Because I think, you know, we talked before on this podcast, and it's this old point about that Tarantino and Rodriguez talked about when making Grindhouse. So imagine these films with these posters that never lived up to the movie you were promised did. And what's crazy about these Italian films is just watching five by the same director and same actor is none of them are a disappointment. They are all, one is kind of.
No, I think they're all good. All these movies. The only thing is we are cherry picking. Like, it is the thing about Italian cinema, though, especially this exploitation stuff, is like, if you're like a real connoisseur of the stuff, like, you wade through a lot of junk. A lot of junk. I mean, we're literally recording in front of box sets of forgotten gialli, you know, movies from Vinegar Syndrome that, like, two out of the three out of every box that they send you, you're like, all right, two stars, I've seen it now, I'll never think about that movie again. And then there's one, like, fucking certified banger.
Well, it's kind of similar to, like, my obsession with slasher films, right?
Oh,
where you have about less than 10, fewer than 10, like, great ones. Then you have some kind of curiosities, and you have a lot that are unwatchable movies.
Oh, yeah.
Actually unwatchable shit, which I still watch.
Uh-huh.
You know, but you're right. We are cherry-picking, but I have been very amazed by the Castellari films with Nero. I had seen only one by him before, which was The New Barbarians.
Okay.
Warriors of the Wasteland is one of the other titles, and I remember seeing that. I think this is over 10 years ago. I was still living in Atlanta, and it really blew me away. I loved it. Very Mad Max exploitation, you know, and
he made a few of those post-apocalyptic movies.
Bronx Warriors, mm-hmm. Escape from the Bronx. The Bronx. But it was like, which is funny because it's like, he's also ripping off of Escape from New York, which wasn't a monster hit. It wasn't this big Hollywood, like, it was known as a cult film, but it wasn't like you're ripping off, like, Jaws, you know?
Oh, totally. I mean, which, you know, Castellari with Great White, which is one of the most insane fucking movies ever made. But no, you're not wrong. It's just, it also feels like, you know, in true Italian fashion, they kind of had their finger on the pulse of what was also just cool in movies. And, like, we're like, okay, even if they're not directly ripping off, like, one in particular, they would draw from, like, a lot of different influences and, like, piece this shit together so that, again, they're entertainments. These were cranked out by these filmmakers as purely a job. Like, these were, like, blue-collar dudes who a lot of the time came up on film sets, like, knew somebody like Lamberto Bava, you know, being related to Mario Bava and working on his movies and working his way up.
Yeah.
Michele Soavi, you know, apprenticing under Dario Argento, working his way up and then making stuff like Cemetery
Argento
Man.
Working with Leone.
Argento, you know? Working with Leone. I mean, Bertolucci. Yeah. All these guys. The film scene there was really like, it was an economy.
Right.
And these guys worked their way into getting jobs and making their own movies. But, like, they weren't auteurs. Some of them would become auteurs that we would revere later, like Argento or Fulci or anything. But, like, Castellari is a great example of a director who would, like, make a post-apocalyptic movie. He makes, like, a giallo with Cold Eyes of Fear. He makes a lot of these Poliziotteschi movies, these Italian crime films.
Yeah.
And then he finds one of his main collaborators in Franco Nero, you know, one of the biggest stars of that entire film scene. And what do you think, what drew you to Nero? Like, why do you love him as, like, a screen presence?
Because he's the ultimate, he's so masculine. He's electric on screen. Like, I think where it flipped for me was I was watching these and I'm like, wow, this guy's really good. And I'd never seen Django.
Right.
And I went and watched Django and it just clicked for me of, like, this guy, stupid. He had the it factor. You know what I mean?
He had
the pure, and I love that, like, and we'll get into his acting style too, is beyond being one of those handsome actors of all time.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, like, my mom,
like, the camera loves him.
Well, he just looks great in every angle. And I was texting my mom about my kind of going deep on this rabbit hole. And she's like, wait, is he the guy from Camelot? And I was like, yeah, he's Lancelot. She goes, oh my God, we saw that in college and all the girls for weeks would only talk about Lancelot. Like, at my mom's super Christian school, they were all obsessing over Franco Nero. And I was like, yeah.
It's the eyes, man, too. Oh. That's the other thing is he has not just like one of the most sparkly, like striking sets of eyes of any actor ever, but like they seem otherworldly.
Yeah.
Like he looks like an alien sometimes. And like even in Kioma, you know, where they ugly him up and make him this like almost like acid hippie kind of a like gunslinger.
Kind of Grizzly Adams at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really tough to like do anything to cover up those eyes. They're always going to like sparkle no matter how much dirt you throw on his face or no matter how long his beard gets or they're so striking and they convey so much. And like they'll often do in these movies, like some tragic thing happens to one of his characters in almost every movie we watch.
Right.
And like he loses a couple kids and like half the time though, just they wouldn't have some big showy scene that like Castellari would just zoom in on his eyes as they become, you know, ringed with like redness from crying and everything. And that's all you need for like the emotional pull of like what those kids meant to this particular character.
Well, yeah, it kind of connects again to the whole idea of Italian genre cinema, right? Of like, it's a different type of storytelling, right? Of like,
sure.
And that goes with the acting as well. And I'll give you just a little anecdote. We've mentioned Big Dave Carlson on this episode before, but you know, I told him to watch this Corbucci movie, Companeros, which blew me away. I was
awesome movie.
Just that and that Kioma and God Told Me To are my three first watches this year that are like they're going to be hard to beat. Like yeah. I love them all. And my dad is not very open to as we've talked to other types of cinema. And he's like, that's the worst movie I've ever seen. And he's like, the dubbing was bad. The editing was weird. The acting was over the top. I'm like, yeah, Dad, it's a spaghetti Western. Like, you're making fun of the feature, not the bug. Yeah. And I felt, you know, falling down that again, this rabbit hole of these types of films is getting a different mindset of how we watch films and how we like process information and how we process emotions. And like, it's like watching Bollywood, right? You have to kind of get in a mindset to like watch those types of films with the different rules they have and the acting styles. And Nero is part of that, the style of Italian, but also his own thing, you know, that he is. So he can be very stoic, but he can be goofy as hell too.
Well, Day of the Cobra, he's basically playing like a Raymond Chandler, very much Long Goodbye type.
Yeah, very Long
Goodbye.
Kind of
shaggy,
yeah.
You know, burnt out detective who's a total dirtbag loser. You don't get a whole lot of those from Nero.
Well, we could go one by one here, but also with Street Law, where he's a loser.
I mean,
he's a cuck. He's he's the definition of a cuck. He's this complete wiener boy who's emasculated by these criminals and now is trying to get his masculinity back, you know?
I had a friend who had a theory about this movie, and she had a really cool theory, is that she called Street Law. We had watched it, I believe, at an Exhumed film screening, and she called it a rape revenge movie where the man is raped, but he's not actually physically raped. He's spiritually raped, and they take his masculinity away. And the whole movie is about him taking revenge on them to earn it back. And like I really liked that movie, and then I thought about it in that context. I was like, damn, that's the best way to like describe this. Because it really is about this meek dude who gets bitch slapped by these criminals during this robbery, and then he has to essentially, you know, take back his life from them and take back like his masculinity, and he goes after them. And it's fucking, I mean, it's a total Death Wish ripoff, but it's how these movies could take something very popular and recognizable and spin it just, you know, to the left, and you're all of a sudden you have a whole new like new idea, new movie, and it's really great. It's really entertaining.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I love I think it's a great way to look at the film, because like we were talking about it after I'd first seen it, really reminded me of Ron Silver's character in Blue Steel.
Yeah.
You know, he's the villain of that film, but he was saved by a female cop, almost killed during a armed robbery. And now similarly, he's needs to like regain his masculinity by being a murderer. But with, you know, Nero, he is trying to infiltrate the criminal underworld just to get revenge. Like, that's it. He just wants to find these guys. And what's interesting, I think with the
He has no real goal beyond that, too. No. That's what's interesting about it.
Yeah.
Is that if you think about it in the abstract, you're like, what do you gain here? Like, other than you're just fucking pissed off.
No, exactly. And it's a really, and it's funny because early in the film, he fails constantly.
Oh, yeah. Like, he's terrible at it.
He keeps, like, because he's like, he'll go into a place and basically be like, hey, are any criminals here? And they beat his ass. So, like, he gets that car chase. Those guys chase him down. Or, but then he finally, what's really, I think one of the interesting subplots of the film, or just, like, the kind of undercurrent, is that he meets this low-level criminal who's just an armed robber, but he's not, like, a super violent guy. And he blackmails him to help him, like, enter the criminal fraternity. And that's kind of an interesting relationship, because you have this very much like, if there's a theme here, is on top of what we're talking about, the rape revenge, is this guy will use anyone he can to get ahead. And he sees criminals as these like underdwellers, when in fact, this guy's a human being who just wants to get ahead like anybody. You know, it starts to have a more gray look. Not everyone is an evil criminal.
The morality in these movies is very murky.
Yes.
A lot of the time. Yeah. But it also takes the criticism. This is what I always kind of liked about Street Law, is that it takes the criticism of Death Wish. Particularly, I think it was Pauline Kael who leveled it against the movie, is that it was a fascist movie.
Yeah.
You know, which it is when you watch it.
Oh, yeah.
But it takes the fascism of Death Wish and applies it to Italian culture, and basically the time period in which these movies were made and are commenting upon was, you know, a time of a lot of corruption in kind of low level Italian society, or like the middle class. And like a lot of the Poliziotteschi movies are a response to that. Like, there's this whole box set that's kind of sitting right here that Arrow put out, the Years of Lead, you know, movies that comment on the times in which they're basically being made. And like Fernando De Leo's movies are like, you know, huge comments on like the fascism of the time. So like, it took that idea from Death Wish and just made it, well, very Italian. It just threw some marinara sauce on that motherfucker.
Well, it's kind of like we talked about, obviously, many times, the French New Extremity, and how like torture porn in America, they were both being reacting to fascism and to this like torture, yeah, you know, torturous history of both their countries.
And I think I hadn't thought about you. I'm glad you brought up your fascination with like slashers. I mean, our shared fascination with slashers, but how we watch every single one. I hadn't thought about Italian movies and like applying to kind of like the same way that we explore stuff. Because, and then it also made me think about how, like, I'm now again more surprised that you hadn't gone down this path up until this point, because one of the kind of great joys of watching a bunch of these movies, especially in a row, is seeing the variations that they would come up with. Like, you watched a bunch of spaghetti westerns, and like Django is totally different from Kioma, which is totally different from The Great Silence, which is totally different from Companeros.
Yeah.
Like A Bullet for the General, all these movies, like they just are, and they're all radically different from, you know, the Leone films.
Yeah.
So it's like, it makes sense that you would, you know, once you started watching them, you really took to them because you love just picking all these kind of little nuances out of the actual filmmaking itself.
Oh, it's, I mean, and I appreciate that. I think it is, what's been kind of fun about this project in particular has been also, because obviously I think you and I are both very director people, or like a lot of film people are, and it's like, oh my God, there's a stacked amount of these amazing directors over there. You hit that node, and then you spread out for 30 films beneath that guy. You go to Corbucci, you go to Damiani, all these people, and you're like, Testi, you're like, holy shit, like, it just never ends.
Well, and that's the thing, is we can and might, I actually thought about this the other day while we were talking about all the Radiance film releases, that we could do a whole other episode on Nero, just with his collaborations with Damiano Damiani, which shit like, you know, Day of the Owl and How to Kill a Judge.
Yeah.
Like, and those movies are radically different from the Castellari collaborations. Like, yeah, they're a little more artful, a lot less arch, and a lot less being just kind of straight entertainments. But I do want to get back to the idea of these movies just being cranked out, because I think Castellari, a lot like one of my favorites, Umberto Lenzi, which we'll get to during your journey. You better believe that one.
Yeah, I've watched a few of his.
Well,
yeah,
and he would work with Maurizio Merli, who is essentially the knockoff Franco Nero. He looks almost identical, blonde hair, mustache, very striking, but like he's almost like if a much more blunt force Franco Nero, which, yeah, I mean, is kind of ridiculous when you think about it, because, you know, Franco Nero will literally enter scenes and just slap people in these movies. It's incredible. You can almost rate how good each movie is by how many people he slaps. It's almost like how many people Jason Statham headbutts in a movie.
Well, it's something we were talking about offline, and I'm sure we'll get to it eventually, even now, is just that he's such a physical actor. You know,
he's an athlete.
He is so, there's that shot in Kioma that I was just rewatching some scenes before we, cause I watched it like 3 weeks ago. I was just trying to refresh my memory. And there's that moment where he's captured toward the end, right before he's crucified and on that wheel, which is so fucking cool. And he,
in the rain,
it's just so atmospheric. And it's like, but there's a scene where he's captured and then he sees like the one of the main bad guys, and he just runs at him, and he jumps like 4 feet in the air.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it's a slow motion shot, and he's like, he's so physical. And like, you watch like in all these films, great fucking fist fights. That's Castellari and Nero working together. They're really well shot. They're really well choreographed. They feel real. They probably are somewhat.
They're kind of sloppy the way real fights are.
100%.
With dudes falling over like furniture,
yep,
missing some swings. Like, there's some sloppy punches, but like they leave it all in, so it feels like these guys are actually fighting.
Yeah, they're very like kind of brawling feels.
They remind me of Paul Thomas Anderson's fights. Like stuff like in The Master.
Yeah.
You know, when he, you know, he's the photographer and he fights that dude in the store, and how, yep, it just, they're like stumbling over things, and he hits him
awkward,
in the ear,
yeah,
at one point. Like, it's just kind of like the way people actually fight, as opposed to like, you know, when we watch like a Hong Kong movie or something with like actual martial arts and things. Like, these are just brawls.
Well, and that's an interesting kind of segue too, to like Castellari, like, you know, you're saying that he, like a lot of these filmmakers, was cranking out these films, and he made so many films, and he's still alive, which is he's in his late 80s. And but what's really cool, I think, about his films is that while they are, you can tell, like kind of down and dirty, he's a really amazing action director. Like, his car chases are phenomenal. His gunfights, I think, are one of his best things. Like, they are, there's a gunfight in Kioma, like one of the like last fights, where he's showing down. He's got his dad, he's got Woody Strode on his side, and they have this huge shootout in the town square. And it's really well put together in terms of space and in terms of like the topography of the town. But then you have like awesome gunfights in like Day of the Cobra, in High Crime, all these really great things of people going through like old factories or old like storage areas, and kind of
that,
like,
shotgun battle at the end of Street Law.
Yeah, I mean, he's like,
they're a lot of slow mo too, very peck and paw-ish slow mo.
The peck and paw flipping between normal motion and slow mo back and forth, like,
yeah,
there. But it works, you know. But I think he's a really like, and also some pretty crazy stunts. I mean, Shark Hunter has a very insane. The stunt scene in my mind is him chasing down a boat with a plane.
Yeah.
Like, that's fucking, looks unsafe to me.
Oh, these movies were not made with permits.
Yeah.
Like, they,
right,
they got out there, and it, I mean, it makes sense that after you've watched a bunch of these, you've kind of transitioned into watching a bunch of Larry Cohen movies, because we're going to do an episode on him next.
Yeah.
That is
interesting.
He has a very run and gun sort of style too, to where he's making these movies guerrilla style in the, yeah, streets of New York. Like, that's how these feel shot, only they're in Genoa. And I think that's one of the cooler things about them too, is that, like, you know, where you watch a Larry Cohen movie and it's kind of like this snapshot of New York City during the 70s or 80s.
Yeah.
And like it's very, it gets into the sewers and the streets and the apartments and everything. Like these movies, particularly High Crime, when I watched rewatched it yesterday, is like it gets you in the streets of Genoa. Like, they're almost like travelogues for Italy, and they transport you to these places. And I think that's what's cool about his spaghetti westerns, too, especially with, like, Kiyoma, is that they feel otherworldly, but they put you in that world because they're, like, for as, you know, almost Carpenter-esque, not the movie, just, like, in terms of, like, the job, like, they're just put together
yeah.
as, like, a sturdy piece of furniture. Like, he still is, like, a lot of the details are there to make you feel like you're in the world with this kind of, like, hippie gunslinger.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, with Kiyoma, I agree with that is, and again, my kind of new understanding or just, like, new appreciation for a lot of these spaghetti westerns is the fact that they're not trying to even pretend that this is Wyoming, that this is actually the American West. And you know, Kiyoma in particular has these big rolling green hills, you know, there's these crazy chase scene over that. And then the town itself, it looks like something out of Conan the Barbarian.
I was going to ask you about that because you had brought that up before, that comparison.
It's Milius as fuck. I mean, it's really masculine, you know,
and
like
mythic.
Like, and mythic and like, you honestly, if you watched Kiyoma and you didn't know and you just watched like a few frames and then you watch Conan, you're like, this could be the same filmmaker.
It's yeah.
very similar, especially everything in the early scenes at like the barbarian camp in Conan feels very similar to a lot of the opening scenes.
Like continuously talking to that old woman almost like she's an oracle the entire
yeah,
time.
Or like the fates or yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Like it has this very mystical, almost like Greek level approach to like storytelling to where it's minting a legend in real time. And it's also kind of cool because like Kiyoma comes towards the end of spaghetti Western's popularity.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it's kind of like how we got, you know, Deep Red and stuff from Argento
right.
is that these guys also would, you know, work in these genres and they would work them to death to where even they got tired of like making this type of movie. So they almost make these grand statements to put a period at the end of their sentence and be like, all right, now I'm going to go make giallo movies now, or I'm going to go make crime movies now or post-apocalyptic movies or whatever. I just need a break from doing this one thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. Cause it definitely feels Kiyoma also just feels very, it's very epic, it's very big, but it's kind of like a period on a sentence, you know,
right.
in a way. But I think what's funny about this movie, too, is, you know, and I was watching with Val, my girlfriend, it was just, you know, she kept looking up from her phone and hearing the song. The music is the weirdest fucking thing.
I think it's the make or break choice for yep. most people is that, you know, you show this movie to 10 people, you know, I guarantee you, like, at least three or four of them are like, what's up? I couldn't get into it because of the fucking weird like music. Because it's almost, again, like the Greek chorus of the film is like this rambling acid folk theme song stuff. But there's multiple themes and they're singing about Kiyoma's journey and like what's happening on screen
at that moment.
And you're just kind of watching it being like, what the fuck is this?
It's and it took me a while because I mean I you're totally right. I was reading some just like user reviews. And I was on IMDb, right, and Letterboxd, and people were like, "This would movie be a 10 out of 10," but that fucking music, you know. And for me, I don't love it, but I think it is makes it actually really interesting. To your point about the Greek kind of chorus, like it's just funny where, you know, with a good Greek chorus, it's helping to support and to give a deeper view of what's happening. But it's like, there's one part where they have the male singer who comes in. And they're both also, it doesn't help that both the singers aren't very good.
No.
Like they're kind of flat.
They warble.
She purposely warbles and he's kind of flat.
Like, yeah.
And so there's this moment where it's one of the
but
final.
But it sounds like how troubadours you would imagine would sound.
Exactly.
If they're telling the tale of Kiyoma. That's how I always imagined it.
Well, and it also is like two people who it feels like English is not their first language.
Yeah.
And they're singing in English. And there's this guy who goes, there's during right before this huge battle, and it's like my favorite scene, I think, in the movie, this huge shootout, and the music starts up, and the guy sings, "Now I'm standing in front of these men," and he's like, he's making it up as he goes along, and I started like dying laughing. But I think that also, you know, with a lot of these films, like, there is a camp quality to them as well that really, with some of these films, that helps, especially Shark Hunter as well, that I think brings it into an interesting.
I've never viewed them as camp, but then again, my experience with them is different from yours, is that this was a big part, particularly at the Exhumed screenings, right, of like my film education, you know, like seeing Lucio Fulci movies in 35 millimeter. They would do these types of Westerns, like they would play The Great Silence, all the Corbucci stuff, and some of the, you know, they would play the Umberto Lenzi like crime movies, and they played like a lot of, like, Lenzi's one of the guys I can't wait till we get to, because you really go through these kind of weird genre shifts and like trends. Like, you can almost track what was popular at the time in world cinema through what they were making, because like they basically invent the cannibal movie with like Man from Deep River, and he goes on to make like Eaten Alive, which is like one of the end cycle movies, which is one of the gnarliest ones too. But you know, he's also making these Italian crime movies with Fabio Testi that are really, really cool. And they come up with one of the great villains in Italian crime kind of history, El Gobbo, which the Hunchback, which I can't wait for you to experience.
Is it horror?
He is a dirtbag. No, they're crime movies.
Ooh.
And he's like this psychopath who's just like this nefarious, omnipresent, like, agent of evil.
Almost like Dr. Mabusa kind of thing. Like,
kind of, but like in true, but he's just a criminal.
Oh,
like,
wow.
He's a low level thug, and it's fucking awesome, dude. But like, you watch these movies, and you also have to wonder, like, was working in the Italian kind of exploitation film industry, did that require you to be a cinephile as a director, because you had to be familiar with the stuff that you were ripping off? Like, you know, they talk about Castellari saw a bullet and then he makes, you know, High Crime.
Right.
Dario Argento was a film critic. You know, a lot of these guys did write about movies and like grew up also like watching like, you know, Bertolucci films and everything. So it's like, and we talked about with like Castellari, like he has Sam Peckinpah Slow-Mo and all this stuff. So like, you had to be pretty literate with it, I would imagine.
I can only imagine that they're just, you know, just consuming so much international cinema, specifically American genre cinema.
And metabolizing it into like their own kind of versions of it.
But, it, you know, I think, again, to bring it back to the slasher comparison, is I always find really interesting is that these films that would be made to be 100% ripoff of Halloween, right? Like, a film like Final Exam, which they literally, like, the marching orders were make beat for beat Halloween.
I mean, Friday the 13th.
Same thing. And they would go through the beat sheet, and it's like, how do we line up per the minute, basically replicate success, which is how genre cinema works in general a lot of times. But you can't help but it take on its own personality, right? In these ripoffs, in these, like, trying to cash grabs, a lot of times interesting things kind of sprout. And look, there's about these films as well, like you're kind of getting at too, with like they do a twist on it of like, well, I gotta make it interesting to myself, you know, as a filmmaker. And Castellari, who obviously he co-wrote a lot of these as well, and
a lot of them have like four or five writers, like, they almost had like writers' rooms.
But I mean, with that in mind too, like one of the more interesting stories I learned about The Shark Hunter, which again was my kind of like entryway into these movies, was they didn't have a script. And you watch a movie, you're like, yep, that tracks.
Well, I watched it with Savannah, and she even like commented to her, she was like, there's like no dialogue in this movie. And it really is like the entire like opening 10 minutes is almost dialogue free, where it's like him running along a beach when he gets a signal that a shark's like in his trap, and he's gonna go out and he's gonna get the shark. And it's like all of this beautiful beach footage kind of like intercut in, and then this disco music, because they all have, you know, the D'Angelis I think their brothers were scoring a lot of these, and they have a lot of that like kind of wah-wah pedal, like disco feel to it. But like 10 minutes go by and you're just sitting there and you're like, nobody's fucking said a word in this. And then you find out later that they didn't have a script and were basically winging it, making the movie up as they went along. And it's like, yeah, that totally makes sense. Well, I mean, High Crime's kind of the same. I checked the running time when or the time code when I was watching it yesterday, and the first 11 minutes are just the car chase.
Yep.
Like, it's crazy.
Foot chase to car chase.
Yeah.
And, well, and it, you know, I learned about the script thing because on the Severin disc, they have an interview with Nero and Castellari, and it seems like Castellari is ailing, and was a little bit...
He's quite old.
He's old, but he was having trouble kind of remembering, and Nero kindly is like, I'll tell the story kind of thing, you know, like, help, like kind of letting him off the hook.
Yeah, because Nero's aged incredibly well.
Yeah, he's like 84.
And he's still with it.
And he's married to Vanessa Redgrave. Like, I just got his autobiography.
Get it how you live, brother.
Well, they met on Camelot.
Yeah.
They've known, but they didn't get married till like the 2000s. Like, it's so fucking cool.
Yeah, he was just making panties moist in real life and at your mom's college.
You know, it's true, Wheaton College. But he, the story went that, Nero, who was now a superstar, international superstar, these other producers came to him and said, we want to do this kind of shark treasure hunting thing. We want you to play the shark hunter. We have the script. We have like locations in the Caribbean. We don't have a director. And he's like, oh, I got this guy.
I got a dude.
He's like, I got a friend that I've worked with many times to get along super well.
We bang these suckers out.
Yeah, he's like, he comes in under budget. Like, we know we work together well. And they're like, cool. And then the guy who was supposed to, one of the crew members was supposed to bring the scripts in a suitcase. It got lost in, like, basically on the connecting flight, and they never found him. And Castellari goes, ah, fuck it. And so they...
We'll do it live.
You know, they literally did it. So I guess that opening scene, they did it. I think they shot it kind of in chronological order. And he said...
Had to have. If you're just making the movie up...
You like, could feel it.
I guess if you're, like, storyboarding or, like, even doing a rough outline, you could shoot around it. But it's also, like... Yeah, I don't know how that would even work.
No, and it's a lot... That's another fun thing about these movies, too, is that I love about entering a new and kind of, like, economy, like you said, is all the actors who show up in each these movies who are like,
oh,
it's him. Oh, shit, it's him. It's the bad guy from Django. Shows up as, like, the corrupt official in Shark Hunter. And here's this actor. And there's Castellari pretty much in every movie. Like, he's this beefy-looking dude. It was almost like Hitchcock, where I was having fun pointing him out, you know, because he's the, like, CIA kind of looking dude in Shark Hunter. He's a thug. I think just in Day of the Cobra gets his ass kicked by Nero. Like, Nero bitch slaps the director, which I think is super funny.
You could tell they just liked working together because it's like, it is one of the thing about these Castellari movies is, and especially the ones we chose, is that you get a lot of different variations of Nero to where, like, you know, in High Crime, you called him maybe the handsomest man who was ever in like a movie. And he really is, like, he
looks the one
incredible. But then, and he's like a super, tough guy as, you know, I think it's Vice Inspector Belly.
Yeah.
And then, but he just keeps slapping people and fighting with James Whitmore, who's like his boss, and like he investigating corruption and going after, you know, basically the French Connection drug dealers. But like, you get him doing that, and he's like very macho and like in it. And then, like, the shark hunter is like, he's hiding out. Like, the story on that movie is super weird. It's like he was in the syndicate, but then he was piloting a plane with treasure and it went down, and he had spent like 2 years or 3 years on this island as a shark fisherman, like trying to get back to this treasure. But now the mafia has caught up with him and they need him to dive to help them get this treasure. And then someone else comes after it and you're just like, what?
I think it's the CIA, actually.
That's what it feels
it's
like.
It's the company they call it. So I think it's CIA, but it's all corruption. They all want the money.
But Nero is just like this washed up, sunburned. Like, he's pretty similar in this and Kioma.
Yes.
Because they're kind of right around the same time, too.
Yeah.
They're 76, 77, I want to say.
So I think Kioma's 74.
Okay.
And I think...
I thought it was 76 for some reason.
Maybe 76, but I think 79 is fucking Shark Hunter.
Okay.
It's like the end of the decade.
Yeah.
But it looks cheaper. It looks older. Because, well, obviously, it's a beat-up old print that they did their best with.
Yeah, because I know Severin, you know, in doing great work, basically rescued and pieced this movie together from a couple different prints they found in, like, a South African archive or something.
Yeah.
And, like...
Which, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so glad I get to watch it.
I mean, that is the thing, dude. Like, Severin Films, if you just explore their catalog, if you really want to, like, dive into the Italian exploitation kind of genre, like, all you could do is just buy, like, you know, they have a whole the Violent Streets box set that's like all the Umberto Lenzi, like, crime movies. They put out the Carol Baker and Umberto Lenzi box set that's all their giallos together. They've put out, like, the Shark Hunter, like, a whole bunch of stuff. They put out, like, a bunch of, like, Italian crime stuff. Also, like, we should do some Italian war, like, particularly, like, their Vietnam exploitation when they started, like, ripping off, like, Platoon and stuff. Those movies are deranged. Like, I have a whole bunch of those we should run through. But, like, they're doing great work, and they're really saving this corner of cinema for, like, a new generation, and you can't, like, commend them enough for it. Them, Arrow Films does a lot. Radiance has been doing a lot lately.
Yeah.
And then Vinegar Syndrome does a ton of really weird, rare, oddity kind of giallo.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, it's just really amazing to we've talked about this before, but, like, in our age of our digital age of, you know, everything's available at your fingertips on the computer, to find something that's not, you know, or to have a film is like, wow, like, you couldn't have watched this the year ago.
No.
You know, and to have it be not a piece of shit. Because that's the thing, you know, it's the classic story, as much as I like Vinegar Syndrome, of like, oh my God, I found this slasher I've never heard of before. There's a reason I haven't heard of it before.
Well, yeah, you know? I mean, because they put out a couple, like, Umberto Lenzi, like, Hitcher in the Dark.
Yeah.
And there was another one that they put out of his, but, like, you are like, well, there's a reason it took so long for this to actually arrive. And honestly, I kind of feel that way about The Shark Hunter.
Oh, yeah.
You liked it more than I did. I really liked it as, like, a curiosity.
Yeah.
And especially, like, if you're a Nero completist, it's cool to see. But there's not a whole lot going on there. This is clearly something. I mean, the behind-the-scenes story makes total sense when you consider that he was hired on at the end, basically needed to deliver something, and worked under these weird circumstances to deliver this very strange movie.
Well, I think the other way to watch it, and that I find it interesting, is the fast and loose nature of it. Is, we talk about this offline, but, like, they're using real fucking sharks in this movie.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's very, you know, in the... grand tradition of zombie two, right? Of real zombie two, correct?
Yeah,
with real sharks and people, or in the tradition of Mako Jaws of Death, right? Of, like, these, you know, the Italian genre films, not known for their kindness to real animals.
Well, I mean, because that's one of the big kind of controversies about them too, is that Cannibal Holocaust. To your point about animal cruelty. I mean, the turtle massacre.
Oh,
and when they cut the monkey's head off.
Oh, God.
Like,
I haven't seen that movie in 20 fucking years, and I haven't forgotten that.
Yeah, it's one of the gnarliest examples of that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's also a great example of, like, I like how you brought up that, like, you know, a couple years ago, you wouldn't have been able to see The Shark Hunter. The thing that's crazy to me, as somebody who's watched these movies his entire life, I remember when the only way you could see Cannibal Holocaust was on a bootleg that you bought off of eBay, or I bought at, you know, Jesse Nelson's table from Diabolik, you know, back in the day when before Diabolik was, like, a huge online, like, Blu-ray retailer. He used to sell these, like, more or less, like, glorified, like, international bootlegs at a table outside of the Exhumed screenings, also called Diabolik. It was him and Joseph Gervasi, who they were both in Exhumed. Joseph has since kind of moved on from the group and Diabolik, so Jesse still runs it. But, like, that's how I got Cannibal Holocaust for the first time. That's how I saw High Tension outside of
the
Philadelphia Film Fest for the first time, is that I got a disc and it was, like, from Korea or something. But also, like, they showed Cannibal Holocaust on 35mm. And like, that's how I saw that movie for the first time. And for the longest time, it was unavailable outside of like a bootleg or a 35mm print. And now you can fucking log on to Shudder and stream it. And it's just crazy to me to where like we've, with the home video labels and boutique labels and streaming services, like everything that was once cult is now kind of at your fingertips. And yep. Italian cinema is all the better for it, because like before, like unless you were a real kind of crate digger, you weren't watching these fucking movies.
Yeah. Well, I remember even, like, you know, when it comes to Hong Kong stuff, like growing up and like trying to find a bootleg VHS of The Killer, you know, right. which has always had always had distribution problems in the States, of like hard to find the DVD. Then their Blu-ray was out of print, and it was like, you know, very difficult to find these movies. And now it's like, which is great. It's like, I like to see those shadows filled in.
Yeah.
But I do also miss the rarity, I think, a little bit.
Yeah, there's a joy in the hunt, which we can still do, and we have done. Like, we, you know, kind of uncovered The Last Hero, which we'll get into at some point, which is, yeah, like this very bizarre, like, Japanese motorcycle movie that's also fucking awesome.
It's amazing.
But, like, you know, we found that on, like, a torrent site online out of nowhere because, like, Shapiro dug up one screenshot from Twitter and was like, what the fuck is this? And then we downloaded our own subtitles and shit. So, like, you can still have the crate digger experience.
Right.
But, like, yeah, so much of this stuff now is just sitting, frankly, I mean, right on the shelves, like, in front of us. But, I mean, that's cool because you, I mean, to your point, like, I think with all the boutique labels and Plex and streaming and everything, like, we are in, like, this hyper-privileged position where if you want to go down the Franco Nero rabbit hole, you can do it. And, like, we found, like, the one Plex server that we're on has fucking Day of the Cobra in, like, almost 1080p. And we're just like, okay. That movie's, like, hard to see, yep, otherwise.
And four versions of Street Law is on there. You're like, okay, three versions of Kiyoma.
Yeah.
Like,
I have a 4K disc of High Crime, the Blue Underground, who really were, while we're talking about labels, like, Bill Lustig and Blue Underground were, like, the original,
right,
like, champions of, like, bringing these things to home video. Because I remember when he put out, like, How to Kill a Judge on DVD. So, like, and all these labels are basically variations of, like, the stuff he's been doing for, you know, 50 years, it feels like.
Yeah.
But, like, all these movies we can explore now and have fun with and record this episode because we actually have access to it.
Yeah. It's, I think back to when I was a kid and just, like, there were those movies. This is a weird example of, like, I wanted to see Captain Crono's Vampire Hunters. I heard about it in something and I couldn't find it. You know,
is that a Hammer movie?
Yeah. And okay. But it was just like one of those movies.
It was a late Hammer movie,
yeah,
right?
It was like 70s. And it was like, I find the information online, but it wasn't like online shopping wasn't a thing yet. There really wasn't even like a very, you know, available VHS. I just went to the video store and hoped they had shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and it's also like, I remember buying, somebody transferred the like Australian Laserdisc of the original cut of Dead Alive, Brain Dead,
right,
onto a VHS tape and was selling it as like a bootleg that way on eBay. And I remember ordering that so that I could see the original version of Brain Dead that had been cut when it come to the United States and everything, and has like, you know, the crazy like Sumerian monkey prequel and all that stuff. Like, that's not in the American version. So it's like, it's just hunting this stuff down was a real thrill, and now we just basically get to, you know, dissect all of it.
Yes.
You want to get to questions?
Let's do it.
All right.
Thank you.
We're back with questions about Franco Nero and Enzo Castellari's collaborations. Let's start here, Martin. We're going to change up questions just a little bit with our top three, because I'm not going to give mine. And since this is more about you discovering kind of this subgenre in Italian exploitation history, we're just going to ask you on this round, because we're going to do a few of these episodes throughout the year. On this round, what was the top three movies that you watched, regardless of whether or not they have Castellari, Nero, just all your discoveries?
Oh, man. Number one is Companeros. Like,
yeah, you really took to that movie. It's great.
I think it was just the state of our country and the world, like the theme of revolution and also the, just spoiler alert, the ending is really inspiring for such a kind of arch movie.
Companeros!
I'm getting chills thinking about it. Like, there's this moment.
Because that's Corbucci too, right?
Corbucci, and then you have this Morricone score, which I've been seeing around the house and just annoying the hell out of Val, but like it's been stuck in my head. And
another great example of how this was just an industry, and even though we like revere Morricone, and he's written obviously some of the greatest scores of all time for, you know, the Leone films, like he also like will just show up and give you like a banger score for like The Fifth Chord.
Yeah.
Or
The Mercenary.
Yeah, like he just would. But it's, again, it's just how this was also like, yeah, they were artists and everything, but like these were jobs.
Yep.
Like they were just like, hey, Ennio's available. Like he'll fucking crank one out for you.
Well, that's something you and I have always been drawn to workmen of all kinds, you know? And like the whole Baedeker episode is the definition of that, right? Of like, these people who would just do it for a job. But yeah, Companeros really, I felt it moved me.
The real polar opposite too, tonally, from Kioma, and even because I know you had watched Great Silence too, is that it's radically different from even that movie, is that, you know, and also a radically different Franco Nero performance.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Because he's the penguin and Pinguino. And he is this complete, literally he's a mercenary and an arms dealer.
Yeah.
Who's playing both sides. And the end is finally this guy who wakes up and realizes the revolution is worthy and he's going to help fight it. And it's just this last shot.
Very Yojimbo type character.
Very much. Yeah. And same with the mercenary, the very similar kind of, even dressed similarly, but he's the dapper man surrounded by these revolutionaries in Mexico. Number two would be Kioma. I mean, this movie.
Why was this your number one pick for the actual episode to build it around?
I think it was my favorite of the
Castellari stuff. Collaborations.
And it was from the first frame, like the first frame you see is this and very similar to like the opening of Once Upon a Time in the West, where it's very silent at first, a lot of sound and wind and
landscape,
and you have this like slit of light you're seeing from inside this like broken down barn, and it's like the door is moving, but as it's moving you see this lone rider coming in, and it's Kioma. And the introduction of him is so cinematic, and then he meets this,
it's kind of a variation on the Searcher shot too.
He's like Ethan. He's come home. He's a fighter. He has a dark history. He's, you know, coming back and things are not the way they were before, you know.
It's a very melancholy movie for as strange and violent as it is. I mean, it's a movie where Franco Nero literally gets crucified to like a wheel in the rain.
Yeah.
In this massive like symbolic set piece. But it's also a movie where like two guys sit around a table and very sadly discuss like how their lives like ended up where they are and like fighting in the war and like all the people they killed. And you're just kind of watching it being like, for as strange and otherworldly as this film is, it like it takes itself really seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that it doesn't. There's really not a lot. There's like no levity. And you compare that to Companeros, which is really bright. Like,
yeah.
In every way.
It's poppy.
It's poppy. Like the music, the way it's shot. It's all pretty much all daytime.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, and it's this sense of like, You know, it's funny that the friendships of the characters in a lot of the Corbucci films remind me of the friendships in a lot of the John Woo films between like the cop.
Oh, sure.
And it's like these like them fight, you know, blasting with glee at these hundreds of people they're killing. You know, the whole machine gun scene in very similar to Django.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and number three is Django. I mean, like, what a holy fuck, dude. Like,
we should almost just do a Corbucci episode.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've left enough on the table to do that, you know, that we didn't really go deep on him. But like that, I mean, Django was one of those movies. And I was like, the image of him dragging the fucking coffin. I mean, obviously, you see where El Mariachi got it, right? Obviously, you know, the guitar case of what's in it. And I was like, I'm pretty sure he's got a machine gun in there. And I'd seen the image of him on one of the box sets from Era with the kind of like Civil War era machine gun.
It's like a Gatling gun.
And that scene where he's mows down all the racist Red Hood fucks. And it's just cool. A lot of these films also have a kind of anti-fascist mentality.
Well, that's what they were dealing with. It's
awesome.
The perfect kind of antidote with us, you know, right before we started recording this segment, we were all sitting around talking about like ingesting nothing but like garbage when you're online and whatever.
Yeah.
And, like, watching politics and like all the stuff that's going on in Minnesota right now and whatever. It's just like these movies are like an antidote of like, if you want to actually change something, you're not going to tweet about it and you're honestly not even really going to protest about it. You're just going to pick up a gun and start like killing your enemies.
Well, I mean, and you know, but even again, I think why so moved at the end of Compañeros was, and not even on a violent, level, but like I have felt very lazy as a member of this society, as a person who does believe in civil rights and everyone deserves a chance to live and, you know, and no person is illegal. And it's like, that sounds super like quote unquote woke. I guess I'm fucking woke. But like, I also am like, I feel like I'm lazy and I'm not doing my part. And to watch the end of that thing where this guy is like denying being part of this and staying free, almost like the experience I had watching Soldier of Orange.
Yeah.
You know, of like that moment where it's like you can only dance around the elephant in the room for so long.
Yeah.
You know, of like the horrors of like, are you gonna help protest? Are you part of this or not?
I mean, even Kioma too, is that it's literally about a gunfighter who comes home to take out a bunch of racist ex-Confederate soldiers who have like run this town into the ground because they own like the silver mine, right?
Yeah.
That they all work
in.
And they poisoned the water, and that's where the plague comes from. So all these people are like dying under their thumb. And it's like, again, it's a very Eastwoodian character, like Man with No Name style kind of character that he's playing, or like Django spinoff, is that he rolls in and is there to like, he's the gunfighter that like helps liberate the town. But it has this very hippy dippy acid tinged kind of feel to it that almost makes it like hallucinogenic at certain points.
Yeah, totally. Well, it's even to your earlier point about, you know, how a film like Street Law, you know, in comparison to Death Wish, is a lot less reactionary. You know, it is a more progressive, more gray, murky area look.
Unsure if I totally agree. Because it's still about a guy picking up a gun and going out and killing these people who are more or less emasculated him.
But a more complex look at it than Death Wish. You don't think so?
Well, we've teased and prepared for a Bronson episode for the longest time, and we'll eventually get around to it.
Yeah.
But one of my biggest hot takes about, particularly, not the later canon films, Death Wish, those movies are fucking fascist cartoons. They're insane movies.
Yeah.
But the original Death Wish, and I know that even, you know, it's Brian Garfield who wrote the books.
I forget, yeah.
But, like, I remember he even said that, you know, he didn't quite like the kind of more reactionary conservative politics or political kind of viewpoint that they applied to Death Wish as they adapted it into the Charles Bronson movie. But my thing is that I think Death Wish, the first one, has a little more of a complex view
right.
of violence and fascism and everything than it's kind of given credit for. Ultimately, it does become about Paul Kersey getting, you know, picking up a gun because he goes and visits a conservative friend out in like Phoenix, if I remember correctly. And the kind of right wing friend is like, just shows him how to shoot and teaches him like the power of the gun. And it's about he goes back and then just starts hunting like street thugs. So like, obviously, you know, not the most woke movie, we'll say.
Right.
But at the same time, I think it's presentation of Kersey's journey to get there is a little more nuanced than it's given credit for.
Right.
You know, but again, we'll talk about that if we ever get around to Bronson movies.
Yeah, fair. But I just think it's interesting, these films, though, that, like, to your point, regardless, are so aligned for what where we're at.
You know,
in our current state in America and in the world.
Well, it's also just a reminder that this shit is cyclical.
Oh,
like,
my God.
It keeps coming back.
And universal.
And there's always going to be somebody who's super power hungry and corrupt and who wants to disrupt the lives of, like, both the middle class and marginalized people. And, you know, it, not quite what we've seen in American history for a long, long time. Like, we're living through a tough one right now.
Yes.
But these movies are a reminder that, like, you know, in all periods of history, like, this shit, the ugly head of, like, fascism, it is always going to raise itself. I mean, there's also an interesting conversation to have about these movies that say, like, we do down the line, you get into, like, the Fernando De Leo films, like his Poliziotteschi Italo crime movies, is that, like, has dealt with this very directly, but it's also a cool compare and contrast situation of, like, watching his take on, like, organized crime, like, kind of La Cosa Nostra mafia movies that are set in, like, you know, Genoa and everything, versus, like, Martin Scorsese's, like, Goodfellas and Casino and everything, and how, like, there's no romanticism to these guys' lives in the Fernando De Leo movies. Like, there's no seduction of evil. It's just, again, kind of like how these guys approach their work. It's just a job. Like, you're born into it, or you're inducted into it. And, like, the mafia was just a way to corruptly make money during a time when it was hard to,
and
have your finger in basically every kind of pie.
Yeah. Like, what option did you have? Yeah.
Did you ever get to, I was curious about this. Did you ever get to the second Franco Nero Django movie, Django Strikes Back?
So the copy I found is pretty low res.
It's one of those old Anchor Bay titles that I don't think has ever really been rescued.
So I didn't, I'm going to do it. I just was like, I was making my way through everything else, and it does seem like my shit, though.
It'd be up your alley, because it's almost like, what if Django was Rambo and in a South American country, and it's mid-80s, and it's Franco Nero doing, like, a Stallone-type kind of role, but he's still the same character. It's almost inexplicable, because it's, like, Django in spirit, not the actual character. But it's, I think you'll find stuff to like about it. It's obviously not as good as the original Corbucci movie, but, like, it's pretty fucking cool.
Well, it's funny too that, like, we talked offline about how the Django mythos, and how for a while John Sayles was going to make this,
oh yeah,
like, 1914 Alabama, like, basically fighting racists and shit.
I'm, it kind of sounds like John Sayles is Django Unchained to a certain degree.
You know, you're right. Now you say it. It's just, you know, maybe I wonder if Tarantino heard about that. Probably did.
Maybe.
You know, I mean, I'm not saying he, like, stole it, but it's like,
I think Tarantino would almost, like, welcome it, though, too, to be like, there should be multiple versions, because it is in the tradition of how these original movies were made, is that it's like, just because I made a Django movie doesn't mean you can't. I mean, a cool episode we could even do is literally all of the different Django movies that were spun off and all the ripoffs, because there's, like, a million ones, and they all have, like, amazing titles too, in that, like, you could just analyze, like, how those even changed.
Hell yeah.
You know? So double feature.
I would do Kioma with Last Man Standing, the Walter Hill film. I think just stylistically so similar, very cinematic, and very, like, no real attempt at realism here, you know, and a mythic as fuck. Walter Hill, I think, is another person that feels like And obviously, he's that mythic kind of storyteller.
Oh, yeah. He likes the two-fisted macho-ness of it all. Right. And, like, printing the legend. I mean, that's all Streets of Fire basically is. You know? Last Man Standing's a good pick. I was thinking about that quite a bit while watching a few of these movies and how that's as close to, like, a weird Italian exploitation movie that we ever kind of got from America. Like, there's a few others I can think of. I mean, De Palma. Obviously.
Right.
But like Last Man Standing is the closest like an Italian action movie.
You know, yeah, and it's also and it's also Yojimbo. So it's just this crazy
and like Walken doing a real crazy performance as the bad guy in the desert and like these Italian families and like it's a crazy movie.
Yeah,
I like that movie.
And he said very spaghetti western because it's the man with no name. It's right. The whole kind of thing.
And it's one of Bruce Willis's more undervalued roles too.
Oh, I think it's
kind of a forgotten movie at this point.
And he's so solid in it. Like he's really, we did the whole Walter Hill episode and this is one of my favorite Walter Hill movies, but he is like
he's
full
great.
Movie star. Like kind of, again, it's actually quite similar to a Franco Nero.
Yeah.
You know, when he's able to do just physically with not a lot of dialogue that Willis, for how good, actually good of an actor he is,
yeah,
also had such physicality and such screen presence that he was able to do something like this. Oh, he really worked on that stuff with the Shyamalan era of he was very quiet in those films, you know, and very...
Well, that's also know, like a great instance of like an actor reviving themselves because he had kind of washed out. He had a huge bomb with Hudson Hawk. You know, he faces some irrelevance somewhat, you know, and then you get, you know, a run of movies like Last Man Standing, Fifth Element, like all these, and then the Shyamalan films, which really make him a megastar again. But it's like, it's easy to forget that, like, there were weird cycles in Willis's career.
Yes. The early 90s were 92 to 93 and 4 were kind of weird.
Strange time. I mean, the man also gave us Color of Night, one of the weirdest. See, I really like that movie.
I do, too.
But it's also a psychotic movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, maybe we should get, you know, do a Richard Rush episode at some point. I mean, he only made like 5 films, so it'd be an easy one to bang
out. Twist my arm.
And you also get to watch, I think they're doing a 4K restoration. I was reading today that is going to play at festivals of The Stuntman,
ooh,
too.
Ooh.
Which is a real,
I love that
movie. That movie fucking rules.
Oh, yeah. Steve Rail's back. Good well, shit.
Do that. Do Freebie and the Bean and all that. Anyway, we're not going to plan future episodes on here. I do have one question. My double future, and I'll ask the question afterwards, would be high crime and probably, I think it would be cool to do this with French Connection 2.
Oh, I was thinking, yeah, it's
good. The John Frankenheimer movie, because that's a pretty close replication of this Italian style.
It's pulpier, for sure.
It's more violent. It takes place overseas. It's literally Popeye Doyle going and hunting them down. It's kind of ridiculous, but like also pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Hackman's gets to do Doyle again and really leans into kind of like the nastiness of him. And it feels like one of these movies. Like if you had told me instead of Frankenheimer directing it, that it was like an Umberto Lenzi like ripoff of The French Connection.
Right.
Like I wouldn't have trouble believing it.
Yeah, I love that.
And my other question for you is, we covered your favorite, Kiyoma.
Yeah.
We did a list of the top 3 discoveries that you had. What was the your least favorite of the stuff we watched this time?
I'm trying to think of all of them.
Like I think Shark Hunter is the weakest, followed, and even though I like this movie, it's kind of it's very, very slight as Day of the Cobra, which we didn't really talk about that much.
Yeah, and I ended up really liking Day of the Cobra. That was one of the higher picks. I liked it was early on and I was seeing his range of he's such a schmuck in it. Like he is, like you said, this almost like a long goodbye, Elliot Gould, Shaggy. Kind of shaggy FBI, PI character.
And he gets to be funny. It's one of the movies that actually shows you that Nero could be funny. Like the whole intro to his character in his shitty apartment when he's like talking back to the answering machine and everything. It feels like when we first meet Elliot Gould in Long Goodbye.
Yeah, and also with the cat food. And yeah. I mean, in terms of quality, it's Shark Hunter. I mean, like, it's
the weakest. Yeah,
the weakest. I like it. But out of the main run of Castellari, for me, it's probably Street Law, just because I didn't...
Blasphemy.
No, and it's a good movie, but I like him more in these other films. I like his character. I think that's a good, well-made movie, but I think the cuckness of him, the cuckity, threw me off when I was first watching. Like, wait, is he just a wiener boy? You know, and I think it's interesting, but like, I compare that to High Crime, or again, like, I think Day of the Cobra was a lot of fun.
See, Street Law was a huge
entry
point for me into this stuff. Back when Bill Lustig put it out on Blue Underground, that was one of the earlier kind of Italian crime, like, DVDs I remember buying and everything. And like, I really, really like that movie. I've also gotten a chance to see it on the big screen and everything. And it really hits. Like, that shotgun battle at the end just fucking rules. It's one of the better set pieces Castellari has ever done.
Right.
But yeah, I could get it if you're not into Nero's character and like his quest as a character, then yeah, there's not a whole lot else to cling to in that one.
But again, I generally think all five are like good entertainment. Like, it's like, I don't dislike Street Law, but if I had to pick one of like not my style, it's probably...
And as we keep doing this, like, that's kind of the nice consistent thing, is that most of these movies are pretty fucking good. They're, again, at worst, they're like 3 stars. All right, that was a solid entertainment. But at best, I mean, they're like High Crime, which was a huge hit and helped birth this entire, you know, subgenre.
Yeah, and none of them are slogs.
No.
You know.
So remake, redo.
I mean, I think it'd be awesome to do Kioma. I think like it's I don't think it's super, from what my research, not a super famous movie in terms of this, like, people don't talk about the way they do Django. Imagine doing like a Kioma sequel in that universe with a budget, a bigger budget, and knock on wood, Nero's still around to come back and play a smaller part. You know, like, lean into it in that kind of Tarantino way. But I mean, I think it's just, I want more Kioma. Like, I just like to see more in that world. The rest of them, I just don't see. They're so dependent on that time period and like that context that I don't really see it.
I had a take on this one to where I thought it would be cool if we got to see Stefano Salima, who's a working director now and who is the son of Sergio Salima, who made, you know, these Italian crime movies during the 70s. He made one of the very best ones with Oliver Reed called Revolver in the early 70s, which is a tremendous movie. Also a Blue Underground release back in the day. But he's kind of made some trashier films. Like, he made that Michael B. Jordan Without Remorse Tom Clancy adaptation.
He did this, Day of the Soldado.
Day of the Soldado.
Which is pretty fun.
He made 000, one of my favorite things that I discovered last year. He has a series right now on Netflix that's about, you know, it's almost like his Zodiac, where it's about the Monster of Florence.
Oh, right, you're talking about that, yeah.
That they're hunting in, like, you know, the decades kind of long search for that serial killer. But I would love to see... Because he's kind of followed in his dad's footsteps as this journeyman genre director who does make both American and Italian productions. I'd love to see his take on a Western, because it would just be cool to watch Stefano Salima make like the modern version of this, because he's a very good, technically sound, stylish director who has ties to kind of this historical, you know, point in Italian history.
I like that.
So, Face Melter, yay, nay.
For Kioma?
Yeah.
I think kind of, yeah. I think the fact that...
It's so outlandish.
Well, because Val was like, what the fuck is this? And she was like enjoying it. Just by seeing the energy of the movie itself, it's so weird, it's so arch. Again, we've expanded our idea of what a face melter is. It doesn't have to be hard target.
Sure.
Right. What do you feel? Similarly?
Yeah, I think it's on the border. I think, honestly, out of the two, the one that's like a pure face melter for me, at least, is High Crime.
Well, yeah, well, it's nonstop action. Yeah,
it's just nonstop action. It's you get Franco Nero just slapping motherfuckers left and right.
Car chase,
super macho. All the great car chases. The James Whitmore performance in it is really good.
Yep.
And it's just a solid, straightforward crime movie with a lot of just incredible action in it that ends on like a very down note, like a lot of these movies did. Like, that would probably be my pick over Kiyoma for like the face melter, but I do agree with you that it, like, if it's not, it borders on it.
Right.
You know, and it's at least like there's something to be said that we're now literally going to do an entire series on these types of films and like this Italian exploitation is because like it was enough that you were like, you were literally just like pipelining this shit straight into your eyeballs at a rate to where even I had trouble like keeping up to where I was like, damn, he's really taking off with this one. So it's like there's when something
you're,
to be
and
said.
You're usually ahead of me on stuff. And
that's
I
what
just,
I mean.
And I clicked in.
It helps that I've seen most of this. So I'm right. more doing like catch ups, but like it, there's something to be said that you liked these movies enough that you're like, I want to see it all now. Like, it's just, and like, you, that kind of helps redefine what a face melter is too.
Yeah.
So Martin, this has been great. I'm so glad after so many years of nagging you,
yes.
that you just randomly decided right now was going to be the time that we're going to do Italian exploitation. Like we said, we're kind of, we've been brainstorming how we're going to keep going through this. At first we were going to do director and actor pairings. I think we should just jump around and do crazy shit.
Yeah.
Like watch the Umberto Lenzi and Fabio Testi stuff. I mean, like even with Castellari, you could do like right here. I have the Arrow double box. That's the Big Racket and the Heroin Busters, one of which has David Hemmings in it. The other one has fucking Fabio Testi in it. So it's like there's even stuff we could do with Castellari that's outside of,
yep.
you know, the Nero team-ups. But also, like, it gives us room to do Giallo movies. We could do fucking post-apocalyptic movies.
Yep.
Italian crime, a different, like, couple on Italian crime movies. Again, like I'd love to do a second Nero episode about him working with Damiano Damiani.
Other Westerns, spaghetti Westerns.
Other Westerns. I mean, like all this stuff. I mean, we could even do the more an episode on the more artier stuff that like Radiance is putting out like,
yeah.
with like Damiano Damiani's like A Man on His Knees. And was it Come and Play is the other one?
I don't remember.
I can't remember. I have to look it up. But either way, we're going to keep doing these. They're going to be spaced out kind of throughout the year so that we take a break. I do think that if you mainline too much of this stuff at once, you will get worn out on it because, especially once we get into Giallo stuff, like you get a lot of sameness and like a lot of junk.
Yeah.
But the next episode is going to be another one. This is great, by the way, because like you're just getting interested in my guys now. And so it's like, we're going to do Larry Cohen
yeah.
for the next one because you've now been just piping Larry Cohen straight into your veins.
I'm back in that mode of just like...
And you're hooked on it.
Checking. When Val's like, is that another Larry Cohen movie he's put on? I'm like, yep.
And he's like one of my heroes. Dude. I even did like a career retrospective like interview with him back during the BMD days. But like, you're going to have to stay tuned to the next episode of Secret Handshake to find out what Martin liked so much in those ones, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Django! Django, have you always been alone? Django! Django, have you never loved again? Love will live on all. Life must go. Face another day.